And what we're going to be dealing with today is what I'm calling Yeshua the Foundation Stone. Now, before the recording started, so all you folks watching this, you didn't get to hear all this. We were talking about why I wanted to bring this subject together or present this to you today. So just to kind of let everybody out there watching kind of get in on our conversation, in the Hebraic Roots movement, in the Messianic movement, there's a lot of different things, a lot of different issues, topics that people are discussing, and that's fine. Even debating, that's fine. But then there's a lot of things that is bringing division to the body. And here's why this is so crucial that we discuss, understand what's going on, and deal with it. Because according to John chapter 11, in fact, turn over there to John chapter 11. I'm not going to, for the sake of time, read it all, but I'll just refer to some things. But in John chapter 11, beginning around verse 44, I believe it is, 45, somewhere in there. This is just after Yeshua has resurrected Lazarus, or Eliezer, from the tomb. And when there were some who had saw what had happened, and with this man being dead, being raised from the dead, there were many Jews, it says, who believed in Yeshua. Are we in the right spot? Okay. So there were many who believed in him, but then it says that there were those who went and ran to the chief priests and the Pharisees and the guys in charge saying, look, we need to do something about this guy because he's doing all these signs and if the whole world's going to follow after him. And if we don't do something, the Romans are going to come in and take away both our place and our nation. Do you see that in the text? Now, what nation do you think they were concerned about? The nation of the Jews. Judah, right? So they're concerned about the Romans coming away and taking their place and their nation. But then one of them stands up, and his name was Caiaphas, and he stands up and he says, you men know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die and not the entire nation. And then John goes on to comment, he didn't say this of his own authority, but because he was high priest that year, he prophesied that Yeshua would die for the nation. That is, the nation of the Jews. But then he goes on and says, but not for that nation only, but that he would gather together in one the people of God who were scattered abroad. You see that? So according to John chapter 11, the Messiah came to do what? To die for the Jews? Yes, he came to die on their behalf, right? The gospel goes to who first? And then the nations, right? But it wasn't just for that. But that he would gather together in one the people of God who were scattered abroad. So if you will, these two basic categories of people. Is that what it says? So I'm not ethnically Jewish. I'm going to go out on a limb and suppose that probably a lot of you aren't ethnically Jewish. So which of those two categories am I going to fall into? The ones who are scattered abroad. So what did he come to do? To gather together, to make one, the people of God, to join them, if you will, to bring these two and make them one. And so this is a principle that's here, and it's in a host of other scriptures. Yeshua came, he went to the tree, he died, he was buried, he was resurrected in order to, you know, just to make it simple, to make the two one. Everybody agree with this so far? All right, then, if we know what Yeshua's objective and what his purpose was, then by default, we automatically understand what the adversary's objective is. Follow? In other words, if the Father's purpose in sending the Son was to make the two one, then automatically we know what the adversary's objective is. And what is it? To keep that from being accomplished, to keep them separate, to divide, to keep a contentious environment. Everybody agree with that? So, in kind of getting rolling here, we know that the adversary comes to steal, kill, and destroy. Right? According to John 10, that's what a thief does. Steals, and he kills, and he destroys. And I believe, particularly in that order. And maybe we'll come back to that. But steal, kill, and destroy. But when he comes to steal, kill, and destroy, he does not say, you know, I'm the adversary, and I'm here to steal, kill, and destroy. does he? He doesn't announce that kind of information. What does he do? He comes as an angel of light. He comes as feigning to be this nice guy, if you will. But what is his objective? To steal, kill, and destroy. His methodology is what we need to look at. How he does this. And going all the way back to the beginning, here's what we see of his methodology. He's really good with his mouth. He's a really smooth talker. He talks really eloquently, if you will. He's very convincing in his arguments, if you will. So going all the way back to the beginning, here's what we see the adversary doing. He first engages the woman in this conversation. Has not God said that you may freely eat of all the trees of the garden? So he's putting it back on her. Hasn't God said this? And then she responds, we may eat of all the trees of the garden except this one. We're not to eat of it. We're not even to touch it, etc., etc. And then the adversary says, you're not going to die if you eat from the fruit of this tree. He takes away from the word. And then he says, but God knows in the day that you eat of the fruit of this tree that you will be like him, knowing good from evil. He adds to what God said. So from the very beginning, understanding what his objective is, let's look at his methodology. He's not throwing things out there that he knows she wouldn't be tempted by, things that would be blatant and obvious. He actually gets her to talking about what God has said and tries to get her to deliberate over the intent of what God has said. And while she's, if you will, mulling all of this over, he very subtly takes away from what God says and then adds to what God said. And what was the end result? We know. She came to the conclusion that the fruit that was growing on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was good for food, and it was pleasant to the sight, and the tree was something desirable to make one wise. And that's a key phrase, I believe. Because at the heart of her giving in to this, and then turning to her husband who was with her, at least where she was concerned, it was about becoming wise. Not only to satisfy what she saw with her eyes and maybe something else, but it was something desirable to make one wise. And so here's the adversary's methodology from the beginning. He gets God's people, let me put it that way, to start deliberating over what God really meant when he said this. And then in the process, he's taking out from what God said and he's adding to what God said. Are you tracking with me here? And we can see again and again how when he comes to Yeshua in the wilderness, what's one of the things that he used to try to tempt him? What did he do? He's really good with words, right? Is it not written? Right? You remember a guy named Balaam? Balaam. You remember this is a guy, a seer, that apparently around that part of the world was well known. And Israel has come out of Egypt and they're coming through the wilderness and they're passing through Moab. And Balak, the king of Moab, sends emissaries to Balaam, hey, come curse this people for me, because they're numerous, and I need you to do something about these people. And so he sends emissaries and said, if you'll do this, then I'll give you riches, and I'll give you prestige, and I'll give you all these things. I just need you to come curse these people for me. So Balaam says, well, I need to talk to God about this first. And so God says, don't go with them. And he says, oh, I can't go with you. God says, I can't do that. But stay the night, and I'll check with him in the morning and see what he's saying. So they stay the night, and he comes out in the morning, and God says, well, go, but you better say only what I tell you to say. And so he gets on his donkey, you'll remember, and he's heading that way, and the donkey is driving him up into the wall. You know, he's just kind of sitting down and all this kind of stuff. And to the point that Balaam does what? He gets that stick, starts whacking at him, starts beating him, and the donkey begins to speak to Balaam. And apparently, Balaam was accustomed to speaking to donkeys all the time because he just starts talking to him like nothing happened. Well, I thought that was kind of odd anyway. But then his eyes were open, and what does he see? He sees this angel with sword drawn, ready to take him out. Do you know what that suggests to me? That Balaam, even though it doesn't say that this is what he was doing, it suggests to me that he's contemplating, how can I do what God says to do and still get my hands on that money and that prestige? Because the angel reminds him, you better say only what God has told you to say. So he goes on his way and he reports to Balak, and he goes up to the top of the mountain. He's looking out over Israel. He goes up there to curse, but what does he do? Blessed. Comes back a second time to curse. What does he do? Blesses. Comes back a third time. What does he do? Blesses. And Balak is like, man, just shut up. Just don't do anything. I wanted you to curse, but now you've blessed. He said, God says bless, I must bless. And here's why. Because I'm convinced from the Scriptures that you can't, the adversary can't curse what God has blessed. He can't curse, and no one else can either, what God has blessed. When Noah gets off the ark, he and his family, they plant a vineyard and they grow the vineyard, and he gets some of the wine and he goes in and has a little bit, goes to sleep. You remember something happened. Who goes in and uncovers his nakedness? Ham. Yeah. But when Noah awakens and discovers what's happened, did he curse Ham? No, he didn't. Who did he curse? His son, Canaan. I'll suggest to you, because just several verses before, it says, and the Lord blessed Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You can't curse what God has blessed. And the flip side of that is, and this is not really part of our topic today, but you can't bless what He has cursed. So if we're ever tempted to pray over that BLT, Lord bless this food, nourish my mouth, you know, does it work? All right. But again, the point is you can't curse what God has blessed. But here's what Balaam could do and did. He told the king of Moab, if you can convince and if you can entice and if you can seduce Israel to mix and to mingle with your sons and daughters, they'll do to themselves what you don't have the power to do. Where do you think he got that idea? Was he just that smart? Or is there somebody else, you know, behind the scenes perhaps trying to do? And it's evidence of this. Number one, the methodology is consistent with what we see in the very beginning. The methodology is consistent. It doesn't come as with something that's blatant, if you will, you know, sin against God and all this kind of thing. It's appealing to the senses, it's appealing to this, and it's trying to get them to mix and to merge and to mingle. And what ended up happening there? A plague swept through the camp. The second thing we see here is, while the adversary is incapable, apparently, and does not have the authority to destroy God's people outright, because if he comes to steal, kill, and destroy, and he does, and if he had the power and authority to destroy every one of us in this room right now, do you think he would do it? If he could have destroyed you by now, do you think that he would have already destroyed you? If he could have destroyed me by now, do you think he would have already done it? So the fact that we're still here, and we're still plugging along, and we're still moving forward, is evidence of what? He does not have the authority to do it. I'm jumping all over the place, and we are going to get to our subject matter, okay? But this reminds me of the story of the Pesach, the Passover, and what that was all about. It was, the Lord said, I want you to take a male lamb of the first year without spot or blemish. I want you to take it, and on the 14th day of the month, between the evenings, I want you to slaughter it, and you're going to go and roast it whole with fire, and you're going to eat it with matzah and bitter herbs inside your home. But you're going to take the blood of that male lamb without spot or blemish, and you're going to put it on the doorposts and lintels of your home, because I'm going to pass through the land of Egypt, and I will strike down the firstborn of both man and beast from Pharaoh's house down to the prison cell. But when I see the blood, it will be a sign between you and me. It will be a token, if you will, of this relationship we have. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Now, when I was a kid, my first introduction to Passover, probably like a lot of yours, was Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. Right? That's the first time I ever heard about Passover, because I grew up Church of God. We don't do Passover. You know, we eat ham on Easter Sunday. So my idea of what was meant by I will pass over you was, what he really was saying was, I will pass by your house. I'm going to pass through the land of Egypt tonight. I'm going to strike down the firstborn. And when I see the blood on the door of your house, I'll pass by your house. I'll pass over and I'll go to the next guy's house until I find one that didn't put the blood on the door. That's what I thought it meant. And this was reinforced for me by the movie. Because you'll remember that Joshua is in love with Lily, and Lily is serving Edward G. Robinson on the night of the Passover, remember? So Joshua cares for Lily, so what does he do? He brings blood to Edward G. Robinson's house. And he's very hurriedly putting the blood on the doorpost of Edward G. Robinson's house, because if you'll remember, the green fog was already coming down the street. And so it's meandering down the street, so he's having to do this in a hurry. And so when he's done, he runs off. The green fog comes down there and kind of hesitates in front of Edward G. Robinson's house, if you recall, thinking about it, because this is Edward G. Robinson's house, but then passes by. That's what I thought it meant. But really what it means is, if you can imagine a mother hen with her chicks, and she's with her little chicks, and she begins to sense that something's wrong. There's danger lurking out there. She feels threatened. What she will do is she will run up to her little chicks, and she will extend her wings and pass over them to shield them and to shelter them. That is actually the meaning of Passover. Because when Moses told them to put the blood upon your doorposts and lintels of your home, because when the Lord passes through the land of Egypt tonight and he sees the blood, he says he will pass over you and will not permit the destroyer to enter therein. Meaning, he will pass over you, not pass by, but will not permit the destroyer to enter in. It was the destroyer who had to keep moving down the road, because he is passing over you. He is sheltering you with his wings. And so, a psalm that comes to mind is Psalm 91. And if you don't mind, well, let's turn there and read a little bit. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. And so the point is then, is that what is being conveyed to us in Psalm 91 is much like what we see in the story of the Passover. It was the blood of a lamb that prompted the Creator to pass over His people, to care for them, to protect them, to defend them, to shield them from the destroyer who was indeed passing through the land. But because He passed over them who trusted in the blood of a lamb, the destroyer did not have the authority to come into that house. Now, juxtapose that with 1,500 years later, Yeshua is coming into Jerusalem and He says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou who stonest the prophets, how I have longed to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. Behold, your house is left to you desolate." Meaning what? because you didn't trust, if you will, in the Lamb, your house is unmarked in that sense, and the destroyer is going to have allowance to come in and to leave you desolate. So as we kind of move into this, we're not only talking at this point about what the adversary is good at and what he's not good at, but what makes the distinction from the beginning of who he's going to have allowance to go in and to mess with their lives. It's the blood. How were they redeemed out of Egypt? The blood of a lamb. He brought them out of Egypt because they trusted in the blood of a lamb. And apparently there were some Egyptians who earlier in some of the plagues that were being poured out upon them, they feared the God of Israel, and they were bringing their livestock inside because they heard that the hail, or I believe it was the hail, that was coming. And so apparently some of the Egyptians began to think, you know, maybe we should do what he's telling them to do. But at any rate, he redeemed them out of Egypt by the blood of the Lamb. Then he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Then he brought them to the sea. He caused them to pass through the sea. And they went to the mountain. And then he said in Exodus 19, "Now, you saw what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bore you unto myself upon eagle's wings." Well, what did they see him do to the Egyptians? The most recent thing is, they saw how he opened the sea up for them, and how the sea closed down over Pharaoh and all of his chariots, and he was destroyed. Let's go down that little trail for just a minute, if I may. Thank you. You're coming out of Egypt, and Moses is leading the group out of Egypt, and according to Shemot or Exodus, when Moses was speaking to the Creator there, the bush that was burning but was not consumed, after he introduced himself to Moses, "I'm the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've heard the cries of my people, and I've come down to deliver them. Here's how we're going to do it. I'm going to send you." And of course, Moses' response is, "Are you sure you have the right guy? Because I'm not really good with words." He says, "Here's how we're going to do it. You're going to go and talk to Pharaoh, tell him that Israel is my son, my firstborn, and I want my son back. And if he doesn't release my son, I'm going to require his firstborn son. And as a sign, you are going to bring the people to worship me on this mountain." That is Sinai, Horeb. And so Moses goes back down into Egypt, knowing that when he brings the people out of Egypt, he's going to bring them to Mount Sinai. Right? Now, Moses has already left Egypt to go to Sinai before this because he killed the Egyptian, remember, and he had to flee the presence of Pharaoh. So when Moses leaves Egypt, he goes to Midian, we're told. And when he leaves Midian, he goes back to Egypt. And in neither of those two cases do we see that he had to cross the Red Sea in order to do it. Point being, he knows how to go to Horeb. And yet, in Exodus 14, as they're coming out of Egypt, the Lord told them that they should turn. And He led them into a place that was called the Mouth of the Gorges in English. Do you know what a gorge is? It's basically a canyon, if I can put it, but not as wide as a canyon would be. It's more narrow. And you have a canyon wall on this side, and you have a wall on this side. You can't turn to the right, and you can't turn to the left. You have to keep going straight. If you will, it is a straight and narrow path. But from a temporal point of view, you're coming out of Egypt. You've got 600,000 men, maybe 2 to 3 million people, including women and children, and you're going to lead them into this narrow passageway that you don't really know where it goes. Who's going to do that? Who in their right mind is going to do that? No human being would. And yet this is where the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud is leading them into this straight and narrow passage. And of course, when they get to the end of the gorge, what's in front of them? A sea. But what's behind them now? Pharaoh's chariots are pursuing. And so, from a temporal point of view, this to them looked like the end of the line. Some of them were saying, were there no graves in Egypt that you brought us out into this wilderness to die? And even Moses, apparently, for just a second, was a little perplexed about what was going on, because in Exodus 14, verse 15, I believe it is, the Lord speaks to Moses and says, why are you speaking to me? Tell the people to go forward. What's the problem with that? There's a sea in front of them. It seems like this is a death trap from man's point of view. It seems like they're going the wrong direction. But even though Pharaoh says the wilderness has shut them in, and he thinks it's a death trap for them, what actually happens? With a blast from his nostrils, just going like that, he parts the sea. The waters stack up in heaps and congeal, forming walls on either side of them. The bottom of the ocean becomes a dry path through which they can walk to the other side. And so what they thought was the end of the line was actually the one and only way they could have gone and saw Pharaoh destroyed. Because it wasn't their death trap, it was his death trap. That was the only way that they were going to be able to go that was really going to lead to their complete deliverance and salvation from Pharaoh. What would have happened when the Lord told them that they should turn and go down this straight and narrow path had they decided to say, no, this path looks wide open over here. That doesn't look right. Let's go this way. What's going to happen when they go that wide open path? Pharaoh's not going to be pinned in either. Pharaoh's going to be able to maneuver. Pharaoh's going to be able to overtake them and to destroy them. And so, what are we told in the Scripture? There's only one way that leads to life. Right? And how is it described for us?
Narrow and straight.
It's narrow and straight. But how is the path that leads to destruction described for us? Wide. And how many people find that one? And how many people go to this one? Okay? Everybody, we're all on the same page then. Okay? You know who led me to go down that straight and narrow path? Yeshua. He's the one who directed, He's the one by His Spirit that drew me into this straight and narrow path. So let's imagine now, I'm following the cloud, I'm following the pillar of fire, and I've come into this straight and narrow path, and all of a sudden the seas open up for me, and I go through the sea. And I see all of that. I witness all the things that happened to my enemies and how He's led me into this narrow path. And that path looks at first a little scary, but then I find out this is salvation. And I come up on the other side, and then He leads me to the mountain. And then He says, now, you saw what I did unto the Egyptians. You've witnessed what I've already done. And you saw how I brought you and I bore you unto myself upon eagle's wings. Now, after this is accomplished, if you will indeed hear my voice and will keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all peoples, for all the earth is mine. Then you'll be a kingdom of priests. Then you'll be a holy nation. And it was predicated, of course, upon if you will indeed hear my voice and you will keep my covenant. That's how you attain this holy nation kingdom of priest status. But who is the one who led us here? So I'm disturbed, folks, when I see and hear and witness folks who were ready because they're so focused on this that they're forgetting the one who brought us to this. Now, I mentioned this earlier. I don't have a board to show this to you in Hebrew. But how many of you are learning Hebrew, by the way? Okay, handful. How's that going? Tough. Some are saying good. Okay. All right. But there's a term in Hebrew. It's called Evan, which means stone. Evan, Shatia. Shatia. And this is a tradition now, so take it for what it's worth. But traditionally, Judaism says that when the Creator spoke the heavens and the earth into existence, that He did so over and based upon the Evan Shatia, the foundation stone. So everything in, not just in earth, but everything in the cosmos was based upon and founded upon the Evan Shatiyah. Now, Evan means stone. Shatiyah is translated here foundation, but its root is the word Shet. Shet, if you're going to spell that in Hebrew, it would be Shin Tav. Shin Tav, which is also in your Bible translated as Seth. You remember who Seth was? He was the one appointed in the place of his brother Havel or Abel, whom his brother Cain slew. So what does Shet or Shit, in this case Shatiyah, mean? It means something that is appointed for this. Notice that Cain, by killing Abel, does not assume that role of being the spiritual firstborn, if you will. But now who is? It's Shet. He is appointed. And that's what it means. So it's not just saying foundation stone. It's actually saying the stone that is appointed as foundation. It is placed there. That is its purpose. And a derivative of this word Shet, Shin Tav, is Shin Yud Tav. Sheet. Sheet. And if, again, if I had a board to show you this, but go home and look in your Tanakh and or your Chumash at the very first word of Hebrew Scripture. Someone tell me what it is. Bereshit. Bereshit. Or in the beginning. And so in the beginning is the very first word. And in that word, Bereshit, if you broke it down into its root form, what is it? Does anyone know? Rosh. Rosh is the root of Reshit, beginning. And Rosh means it's the head. It's the top. If in some sense the fruit, but it's the head. And so Rosh means head, and the remaining letters of Reshit, extracting Rosh, would be Bet Yud Tav, which means house. So embedded, if you will, in the word Reshit is head of the house. So in the beginning, we see the head of the house is doing something. And we could talk about the fact that the word Esh is there, which means fire, which if you take the word Esh out of the first word, what's left is the word Brit, or covenant. So what is the head of the house going to do? He's going to give his people a covenant of fire. When he brought them to the mountain in Exodus 19, what does he do? And he's speaking, but his words were as fire, according to Moshe. But there's another word here that's very interesting. It's the last three letters of Bereshit, Shin, Yud, Tav. And I just told you how you pronounce that. It's Shit. And you know what it means? It's appointed. And in the days of the temple, so that would say he created the Shit. He created, it's alluding to the foundation stone, the Evan Shatiyah. So in the very beginning, what do we have? The foundation is there. And everything is going to come and be based upon that. In fact, in temple lore, there is this belief that there on top of on Mount Moriah, next to where the altar was, there was a natural channel there next to the altar that would, the blood that was there, it was a very bloody affair. I think everybody knows that. But a lot of the blood that was there on top of the mountain, when it was drained down into this natural conduit, if you will, that went from the top of Mount Moriah, and it would empty out and seep out into the valley floor of the Kidron. In fact, traditionally, the blood from all these different sacrifices that were flowing through this conduit down into the valley, it would so saturate the soil of the Kidron Valley that the temple treasury was grown by selling the soil from the Kidron to all the farmers. Now, that's lore, and you can take it for what it's worth. But what's interesting is that this channel or this conduit or whatever you'd like to call it that went from the top of the mountain down to the valley was called the Sheet. In other words, it had to do with something with that stone that was appropriating blood. Isn't that kind of interesting? Now, let us go to Isaiah And we're going to look at verse 14. But before I do that, there's something else in Hebrew I just thought of I wanted to bring out. Isaiah 8. Isaiah 8. We're going to read here in just a minute in verse 14. If I said, "Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz," in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if I were able to spell that out for you, in that first verse of the Bible, there's this word et, aleph tav. Bereshit, in the beginning, bara, He created, who? Elohim. And then the word is et, aleph tav, which is not translated. It grammatically serves as a sign of the direct object, which is the very next word in the phrase, hashamayim, translated as the heavens. Ve, which is the letter vav.